Welcome back to Mountain Money. Well, the company names are familiar to all of us. Ideal, Mattel, Hasbro, Mark's, Lionel. They made the toys that enchanted us all as children. All these companies were born in the early part of the 20th century, and all of them were created by Jewish entrepreneurs. The story of the creation of the American toy industry is told by Michael Kimmel in his new book, Playmakers. We're lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Michael. Thanks for joining us on Mountain Money.
Hi, nice to be with you.
So, Michael, I think I know part of the answer to this, but can you explain to the audience what motivated you to write this book and how long did it take to do the research?
The initial motivation was COVID and retirement, which happened within a month of each other. All my life growing up, there was this photograph on my piano in my home, and it was of an older man and with Shirley Temple sitting on his lap, and it was addressed to my mom, and it said, "With love from Shirley Temple and Uncle Morris." And I had no idea who this Uncle Morris was. She gradually eventually told me that he had been essential in the early years of the toy industry. I didn't know how essential. I didn't really know very much about it, except that he made the very first Shirley Temple doll. So I decided, during COVID, I had just retired. I was thinking about what I wanted to write about next. And I decided to turn to what I thought would be a fairly short family memoir of this guy who, it turned out, had invented the teddy bear and started the Ideal Toy Company. And he was my great-great uncle. And I thought I would write a story about him and how he had the immigrant story of the Yiddish Jews that came in the late 19th, early 20th century, landed in the Lower East Side in tenements, and then became entrepreneurs. I thought that's what I was gonna write. And I thought it would be a nice short little book and the family would be very happy and it would be all over. And what happened was I bumped into all of the other toy makers at the time who all had similar stories. And I thought, this is really unusual. I had no idea. So, I think sometimes you write the book you wanted to have read. So I wanted to read a book about these early Jewish entrepreneurs who created the toy industry. And that's what I ended up writing.
Okay, so let's go back to Morris Victim for a minute, and the creation of the teddy bear, because it's a pretty interesting story. Can you share a bit about it with our audience?
It's a great story. So my great great uncle Morris and his wife Rose owned a little candy store in the Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood in Brooklyn, and he had studied initially back in the old country. He had studied to be a rabbi. He was a voracious reader. He read all the newspapers and. At the time, there were over 40 newspapers in New York alone, morning papers, afternoon papers, evening papers, and four papers that were entirely in Yiddish. He read them all, and there was a story one day in 1902. President Roosevelt had just finished adjudicating a border dispute between Mississippi and Louisiana, and he was tired and grumpy, and he decided he wanted to take a week off and go bear hunting. So he went, but there were reporters and all from various newspapers that had been along with him on this trip, so they all went with him on the bear hunt. And after 4 or 5 days on the bear hunt, they had found nothing, and he was really getting grumpy about this. And so finally, they found this old, scrawny bear. They grabbed it and tied it to a tree and said, "President Roosevelt, come here. You can shoot that bear." He took one look at it and said, "Not a chance. I'm not going to shoot that bear." And this story would have ended there had Clifford Berryman not been along for the trip. Clifford Berryman was the cartoonist in the Washington Post, and he was really extremely well known. And he drew a little cartoon of Roosevelt refusing to shoot the bear. And for some reason, Morris saw this cartoon, thought it was adorable, and said later in his life, he said, "The czar was never so nice." He said, "Rose, let's go downstairs to the basement of their candy store. Let's put together a little model of this, put it in our window." And they called it Teddy's Bear. People came by. They said, "Oh, that's so cute. We want one." And he said, "Okay." So he started making them, and with a bunch of, Yiddish boys from the neighborhood. What Jewish boy at the turn of the century doesn't know a little tailoring? So he went and they started making them. They wrote to Roosevelt and they said, "Is it okay if we call this, name this after you?" And he wrote back, apparently, we've never seen this letter, but Morris claimed it was true. that Teddy Roosevelt wrote back and said, "I don't know what good my name would do in the bear business, but you're welcome to use it," signed TR. And so Morris went into the teddy bear making business in 1902. And 2 years later, he founded the Ideal Toy Company. And that's the story, that's the beginning of the American manufactured toy industry. At the turn of the century, all of the other toy makers were also had stories like him, immigrant Jews or first generation Russian, Eastern European Jews.
And you talk in the book about this generation. Talk a little bit more about what did this generation Jews, this generation of immigrants have in common? Because they did share a lot of the same background in contrast to sort of the German Jews who had immigrated in the prior century.
That's exactly right. So the German Jews came in the mid-19th century. They were prosperous, middle class, and very well assimilated by the end of the century. They were the ones, of course, who had founded most of the major big department stores like Bloomingdale's, Abraham and Strauss, Bergdorf Goodman, Saks Fifth Avenue, after 5 years, Macy's, Gimbel's. All of those had been founded by German Jews. And they were, as I said, middle class and fairly prosperous. The Yiddish Jews who come from Russia and Eastern Europe were completely poor. They all lived on the Lower East Side or, you know, in tenements. They were and those were the people who created the toy industry. Happily, the German Jews said, well, you can sell your toys here. And so they had the kind of infrastructure laid out for them. And so the question for me was, you know, why them? Why yes. there? And why then? And the answer to that was had a lot to do, I think, with what else they brought with them besides those cardboard suitcases held together by string. Morris said he arrived with the equivalent of 20 cents in his pocket when he arrived. And they happened to come right at in 1900, just as progressivism is taking off in American life, which is to say a critique of 19th century. What are the progressive ideas? Compulsory schooling through high school. The idea of adolescence, that there's a stage of development between primary school and the end of high school. Efforts to end child labor. All of these created a new idea that there was a childhood, a stage of life before you went to work as an post-adolescent. So there was a whole age group that now needed to be tended to. More than that, that the idea that these guys sort of had in their heads from the old country was children were basically creative, curious, interesting. They should be nurtured. This was not the idea of the 19th century child rearing manuals. In the 19th century, child rearing manuals, parenting advice columns said things like, you know, you should never hug your child, you know, pat them on the head before they go to bed. If they wake up in the middle of the night and start crying, give them a good spanking. That'll stop them. The idea was that children were willful and the goal of child rearing was to break their will. These Jews come and they say, not for us. That's not what we do. We think children are a blessing. They're to be nurtured. They're curious. And it is not a surprise that so many of the kindergartens and Montessori schools in the early part of the 20th century were flooded with Jewish immigrant children.
Now, is this did which came first, the progressivism or the Russian and Eastern European Jews, or did the
you know it's almost simultaneously because you know some the great reformers like John Dewey at Columbia. You know, the great progressive reformers in education just happened to coincide with them. So these immigrant Jews from Russia created the Child Study Center, created Parents Magazine. The guy, George Hecht, who created Parents Magazine, he ended up buying FAO Schwartz. I mean, all of these. So in a way, it's simultaneous. It just happened. And that answers my question, why them, why there? And why then?
Let's go back to Ideal for a minute, because I think I want to talk a little bit about how Ideal and the toy industry in general was progressing between the beginning of the 20th century and say World War I. Were they starting to organize as an industry?
Absolutely. That's what they began to do. As soon as there was a magazine that unified the industry called Playthings, which began in 1905. And all of these companies, and we're talking about the early ones. We're talking about R&B dolls, F&B dolls, Louis Marks, Lionel Trains, later Hasbro, which was the Hassenfeld brothers, Mattel, which was the Handlers. Everybody knows about the Jewish origins of Barbie. And all of the, you know, so they began to organize. And there was a building at 205th Avenue, which was called the Toy Building. And by the time I was born in the 1950s, every major toy manufacturer had an office in that building. They had corporate offices there. They didn't have their manufacturing plants there. So the toy industry itself began to organize. And as a result, every time there were inquiries into things or scandals, the industry as a whole tried to respond to it.
Yeah, so looking now, was toy making popular in Eastern Europe? Because I look back at the late 60s movie Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and the beginning of that movie took, they had the 1909 British Grand Prix, and then the car went into the garage. Anyways, Benny Hill portrayed the toy maker in that village. Was that common in Eastern Europe, that a lot of villages or serfdoms had toy makers?
No. Okay. No, not at all. So what happened in 1900, there were two kinds of toys in America. There were mass manufactured toys that were almost entirely imported from Germany. Germany was the world leader in the toy industry. And the second group of toys were the homemade toys, Raggedy Ann, you know, rag dolls, or little toy, you know, little toy wagons that were carved by parents out of wood for their children. So there was virtually nothing. And though these Jews weren't like toy makers in the old country, but they came here and they, and many of them, in fact, wanted to do other things besides that. For example, the entire comic book industry was created by immigrant Jewish artists who wanted to go into advertising in the 1920s and 30s. And those companies were so anti-Semitic, they wouldn't let them in. So they said, okay, we'll go to the pulps and the things that got thrown in, thrown on your doorstep, with ads for the supermarket. And that's how they started the comic book industry, was they got rid because of anti-Semitism.
We're going to come back to comic books because I think there's some really interesting stories there. But you sort of set up something really interesting here because you talked about the dominance of the Germans at the beginning of the 20th century. How does World War II affect the ability of Americans to get German toys, and what does it do for the industry? World War I.
Well, both world wars have tremendous impacts on the toy industry. World War I, there was a boycott of German goods, and so that stimulates the domestic toy industry dramatically. They actually begin to really take off. The second thing is, during the First World War, most dolls, Ideal's major area was doll making, and most dolls in the early part of the 20th century were fragile. You did not play with them. Their heads were made of bisque or porcelain. They sat at the top of a brake front, and you didn't touch them. And Morris developed an unbreakable doll head, which he thought would be, terrific. And all the other toy makers laughed at him because they said, well, if it doesn't break, you're not going to be able to sell another one. So, and this is a really great story. You know, Madame Alexander dolls, they're still made today. They're really quite popular. Madame Alexander's, Alexander Berman was her name. And her father was a toy doctor, a doll doctor. He actually repaired the porcelain heads of the dolls. And that's how she got into the business. So the boycott of German goods in the First World War really helps. In the Second World War, the boycott of Japanese goods also stimulated alternatives to rubber. And that led in the early 1950s to a massive plastics industries, particularly in Southern California. You know that great scene in The Graduate where the guy whispers to Dustin, I got one word for you, yeah. Plastics. Yeah. That was true. I grew up in New York. I watched that and I went, what? That was true. That was the center. Mattel's founders started making Lucite frames for pictures and then made and ended up using plastics to make dollhouses. Those were their first toys before Barbie. So again, those wars created opportunities as well as shortages.
I want to get back to comic books just for a minute, because there was a really interesting segment in the middle of the book where you contrast sort of the ethnic story that you can trace to Superman versus the ethnic story that you can trace to Batman. I never realized that one of them was Jewish and one of them wasn't in terms of their backstories.
There are many people who've written about the ethnic origins of Superman, and not least of which is Michael Chabon's Cavalier and Clay, right, which is an amazing book and won the Pulitzer Prize. And so people know the kind of Jewish origin. Siegel and Schuster, the creators of Superman, were first generation Jews in Cleveland. And Superman is the classic Jewish fantasy story in all of the comic books. This schlemiel, this guy who can't get a date. He's kind of passive. And then he takes off his glasses, steps into a phone booth, takes off his glasses, puts his underwear on the outside, and flies off. Right. This notion that inside the heart of every meek and timid young man beats the heart of a superhero, a lion. That is the Superman story. And you'll notice, actually, that every superhero has a superpower except Batman. Batman has no superpowers. He has technology up the wazoo. He has every conceivable cool gadget you could possibly have. But he himself has no superpowers. He is the son of upper class WASP bankers and super wealthy. And so he has all this money. When they're murdered by some specter, then he decides he's going to avenge them by cleaning up the entire city of Gotham. What he uses is his class position to develop all of the gadgets and technology necessary to do that. He's the only one without superpowers. So that's interesting. Now, he does, however, have a Jewish backstory, which is he's alone in the world and he lost his parents. That is the story of so many of post-World War II young Jews who immigrate, who wander through Europe, who come to the U.S., who go to Australia. So there is that sort of, orphan trauma, parents murdered, that people could, even the Jewish guys who wrote and created Batman could relate to.
Okay, so now how did the relationship between content and advertising change in the 1950s, since we're approaching that time?
Well, that's a great story, because in 1955, I think the toy industry, kind of overnight changed. Prior to 1955, advertising for toys was done in grown-up magazines. Because grown-ups would read them, and they would say, okay, I'll get this for my child. When the Mickey Mouse Club debuted in 1955, companies realized they could advertise directly to children, that children would be their sales force, not their sales force, that children would see something on TV and they would say, I want that, and they would go to their parents. So television changes everything. No longer do you advertise, you could advertise in the 30s and 40s, you could advertise on radio, mostly for food supplements, like chocolate syrup for your milk or cereals. But when you could see the object, then advertising changes everything in the toy industry.
Yeah, that's
And although there had been sort of celebrity endorsements, you go back to the Shirley Temple doll that you were mentioning before, did you start seeing more sort of product tie-ins, right, as we get into the 50s?
Product tie-ins are a staple of the toy industry starting in the very beginning, because they used to let go to, the toy makers would go, for example, to comic strips and create, you know, not exactly action figures, but replicas of the Campbell's Soup Girl or Buster Brown and Tig or other, you know, the Unita Biscuit. All of these were tie-ins to products in the early part of the 20th century. Morris Mictum, not only licensed Shirley Temple for the Shirley Temple doll, but also got the license to make an outfit for Shirley Temple that coincided with every movie that she made. So a new movie would come out, there would be a new outfit. And that, of course, creating the aftermarket for a toy that already existed was very clever. Ruth Handler, who was the founder of Mattel, used to joke that Mattel was the largest women's clothing manufacturer in the world because of all the outfits that they created for Barbie.
Yeah.
There are lots of stories we could touch on. I particularly enjoyed reading about the evolution of the dolls and the creation of things like Betsy Wetsy, the idea that you needed to make a doll that would wet herself. I loved that. But I want to get to the interesting discussion you have about how the doll industry dealt with the evolving views of race in the post-war era.
Yeah, this is a terrific story. One thing about dolls is that you had to have a new one every year, because it had to do something different every year. So a doll that wet, a doll that spoke, a doll whose hair you could shampoo, a doll whose hair you could curl, a doll all of these kinds of innovations were attempts to get the kids to buy the new doll of that year. The origins of a black doll is really, really interesting. Throughout the 20th century, there were black dolls, and they were sold through black churches, mostly in the South. And so one day in the early 1950s, a woman in Florida walked out of her local library. She was a local, prominent figure in Belgrade, Florida. Her name was Sarah Lee Creech. And she walked out of her library and she saw some kids playing, some black kids playing in front of the library, playing with white dolls. And she says, this looks wrong. And she was aware of the research by Kenneth and Mamie Clark, which was about black self-esteem, the psychological foundations of Brown v. Board of Education in 1954. Their research in the late 40s gave black and white dolls to black children, and the black children rejected the black dolls. Mm. And so they were talking a lot about self-esteem and things like that. And so Sarah Lee Creech said to her neighbor, who happened to be Zora Neale Hurston, one of the most famous novelists of the 20th century, she said to her neighbor, "This is wrong. We should really figure out a way to do a black doll." And Zora Neale Hurston said, "That's a terrific idea. Let me call my friend." And her friend happened to be Eleanor Roosevelt. Mm. So Eleanor Roosevelt says, that's a champion idea. Give me a couple of weeks. And Eleanor convenes in her apartment in New York City, a kind of a who's who in black leadership. The president of Morehouse and Spelman and Howard University, Jackie Robinson, Ralph Bunche. I mean, all of these great black leaders. She brings them the idea, and then she has to go find a toy maker who will make it. And she goes to all the toy companies, and none of them will touch it except Ideal. Mm. Ideal said, "Okay, we will make the Sarah Lee doll. This is the first large-scale manufactured black doll in America." First question they have to figure out is, what color is it going to be?
Yeah.
I mean, you do a white doll, it's white.
Yeah.
Or flesh, what we call flesh color, or pink. You do a black doll, there's all different shades. So they had to figure that out. They went to a woman who was a ceramicist in St. Louis. She created four different heads that you could use of different shades of blackness. And then they launched the Sara Lee doll and the Sara Lee doll is adopted by New York City public schools as the doll of the year. It's on the cover of Jet magazine, Ebony magazine. It's going to be a big hit, except for one problem. Major department stores like Saks Fifth Avenue wouldn't carry it. And they wouldn't carry it because they were afraid that if they did, black customers would come in to buy it, and then white customers wouldn't come into the store. So it failed because racism ultimately doomed it. And there wasn't a major company that took on producing a mass-produced black doll until Barbie's friend Chrissy in 1964.
Wow. We could go on.
It's an interesting story because the idea is there. They think the market is there. The early history of the black doll proved that there's a market, and they couldn't get the company, the stores, to stock it.
Now, as long as we're on dolls, G.I. Joe. When did G.I. Joe come out, and how significant was the introduction of G.I. Joe?
G.I. Joe, this is another one of those moments where Ideal failed. Toy designers came to them with this idea. Now that dolls were so well entrenched for girls, how about something for boys? Mid 1960s, how about something for boys that would be like military? And the chairman, the president of Ideal, who was Morris's son Ben. Ben said, oh, boys don't play with dolls. Not a chance. We're not going to do this. This, by the way, I want to say this, despite that his father, Morris, had created the most genderless toy in history, the teddy bear, embraced and loved and hugged at night by both boys and girls for over a century. Right. But he said, Ben says, nope, boys won't play with dolls. OK, so the guy says, I really believe in this. You mind if I take it somewhere else? And they said, no, go ahead. So he takes the idea to Hasbro, and they immediately love it, and and that's how G.I. Joe is born. G.I. Joe is born because Ideal rejected their own toy designer, and he sold it to Hasbro.
Sadly, I'm old enough to remember when that happened.
As you probably know, Hasbro still in business, Ideal not.
Okay, we could go on like this for at least another 25 minutes, but the book is Playmakers, the Jewish Entrepreneurs Who Created the Toy Industry in America. We've been joined by the author, Michael Kimmel. Michael, thanks so much for spending the time with us.
Great to be with you guys.
All right.
Thanks.
We'll be right back after this.